Well, here in the first hour of Issues Etc., a very interesting conversation. One of the things that I noticed during the whole Harriet Myers nomination and then the withdrawal of Harriet Myers, I noticed one thing, and it was hard not to notice this. Dr. James Dobson, after hearing some news from Karl Rove, said he wanted to support her, but he was among very, very few of the so-called religious right who were supporting Harriet Myers. Well, Harriet Myers is no longer on the table, and now we have a new nominee. We're going to be talking with Amy White here in the first 15 minutes of Issues Etc. today. We're going to be talking about the rejection of the Myers nomination and how it debunks certain stereotypes about who holds influence and who is kowtowing to whom in Washington, D.C. We'll be talking about that for the first 15 minutes of Issues Etc. today. After that, we're going to round off today's first hour with Dr. Uwe Simonetto. We're going to be talking with him about lay vocation. He's a resident scholar and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation here in St. Louis, and we'll be talking with him in about 15 minutes here on Issues Etc. Coming up in the second hour of the program, we're going to spend some time with Dr. Bob Weiss of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, the subject, End of Life and Bioethics. Dr. Weiss will be making a presentation at the Premier Bioethics Conference of 2005 coming up here in just a matter of days. It's the Image of God Bioethics Conference on Friday, November the 11th here in St. Louis. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in the second hour of the program. In the course of today's program also, we're going to be playing Soundbite of the Week. We've got five of them today from this week's audio, some of from the shows, some of from the things that we've talked about in the news, and you get to vote during that portion of the program for the Soundbite of the Week. Our call-in numbers for all 3 hours, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Amy White is our first guest. She's a mother of two in Oakville. She is a corporate and political speechwriter and author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Rejection of Myers Debunked Stereotypes. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Amy, first of all, your reaction to the whole Myers then come Alito situation with regard to the Supreme Court nomination?
Well, I personally am thrilled that the Harriet Myers nomination came to an end, not only for the sake of conservatives, whose cause I do not think she would serve, but because I don't see any way those Senate hearings would not have been structured in such a way as to embarrass her personally, which as a professional woman I would not wish on another professional woman and certainly not another professional Christian woman. So I'm very relieved that the Harriet Myers chapter, as it regards the Supreme Court, is at an end.
Now, what do you make of Judge Alito?
Well, I personally think that this is a really strong choice by President Bush. He has some very provocative rulings, but he seems very focused on trying to read a conservative viewpoint into the law while still trying to work with precedent. And I think that that's an appropriate way for a judge, a conservative judge, to be functioning within the legal system. So the material that I have reviewed so far gives me great hope that he would be a wonderful addition to the court.
You talk about the whole Myers nomination, the whole rejection of Myers, debunking certain stereotypes that are embedded in the way people think and the way the press tends to report the goings-on in Washington, D.C. What kind of type of stereotypes are you talking about, Amy?
Well, one of the most immediate stereotypes I think that this really did argue against was this idea of evangelicals being the equivalent of sheep who are easily led. A Washington Post editorial in 2001 even referred to evangelicals not only as easily led, but that most of them were poor and uneducated. I think that your experience and my experience with the evangelical community totally debunks all of those perceptions. But I do think that they are stereotypes that much of the professional media has about the evangelical community. So when we see Karl Rove reaching out to Dr. James Dobson, who is a man of great integrity, and assuming that if he can get Dobson on board, he's got the evangelical community on board, I think that it really showed, hey, Dobson's well-respected, but evangelicals are going to look at the evidence on their own, they're going to draw their own conclusions, and they're going to be effective advocates for wherever they come down on the issue of Harriet Myers.
Do you think it was do you think it was a deliberate attempt on the part of the president's chief political advisor there, Karl Rove, to swing Dobson over with the intent of bringing the millions and millions of Dobson supporters with him?
I think that from Karl Rove's perspective, as any political strategist's perspective, if you're trying to reach the evangelical community, you go to the leadership of the evangelical community. And I'm not insinuating that Mr. Rove would be foolish enough to believe that if he can get Dobson to support Harriet Myers, that everyone else is going to get on board. But I think they underestimated his level of influence in this particular regard. And I'm sure it's been a fairly humbling experience for Dr. Dobson as well, because he said from the very beginning that he was prepared to support her based on limited information he had, and that he prayed earnestly that he was right and would not be proven wrong. Now, the course of history has run as such that we don't really know what kind of Justice Harriet Myers would end up being. But when she withdrew her nomination, Dr. Dobson did acknowledge that he was in the process of withdrawing his support.
What are some of the other basic misunderstandings about the so-called religious right, the evangelical influence in politics?
I believe that there are a lot of secularists and a lot of professional people who believe that when evangelicals speak of original intent with the Constitution, when they argue for what we call a strict constructionalist, that what we're really doing is trying to come up with an intellectual way of saying God hates abortion. And that all of our philosophy, if you will, about the Constitution and original intent is simply a smokescreen to get Roe v. Wade overturned. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. I think evangelical Christians are deeply committed to fighting against abortion, fighting Roe v. Wade, but that does not mean that our judicial principles and our philosophies are null and void. These are true principles that we are pursuing for the sake of the Constitution, for the sake of preserving this balance of powers within the democracy, and it's not just about Roe v. Wade.
Now, I agree with you that it's not just about Roe v. Wade, but maybe this is the cynic in me, Amy. A lot of times I think when, particularly public voices among evangelicals, talking about judicial nominees, when they have the opportunity and they think it's in their interest not to bring up Roe, they will sometimes, I think, use code, activist judges, something like that. There are times when that does function as code, even though there may be, as I agree with you, there may be some real judicial philosophy behind it.
Right. I do think that our society, despite all the chattering that is going on the Internet and on the airwaves and in a lot of different venues, despite all the chattering that's going on, it seems that our political communication and our political rhetoric is less and less sincere, more and more tries to avoid the bottom line and the real essence of what we really want to communicate to each other. So I agree with you that that is code. But this idea of reading certain kinds of liberties into the Constitution that make for an amoral or immoral society with which we all suffer the consequences from, there is a judicial philosophy here that needs to be really worked out among the American people. But I agree with you that most advocates for the evangelical community are very comfortable talking about Roe v. Wade directly and are also very comfortable using code, trying to avoid using Roe v. Wade. I've had people email me or say to me in one-on-one settings, now, can we talk about this and not bring up Roe v. Wade? It's sort of something where there's almost some battle fatigue or weariness with evangelicals going back to the same point. But the Roe v. Wade decision was a very fundamental decision. It concerns life and death. It concerns the children of America. And in the column today, I tried to make reference to the fact that it is not a stereotype that evangelicals care passionately about the abortion issue and have been fighting for years to restrict or reverse it in every democratic means possible.
And finally here, Amy, when, and it may very well do just this, when push comes to shove on Justice Alito, what do you expect? What do you think that evangelicals ought to say? What should be their public stance when the battle for his nomination begins?
I think that evangelicals can be honest about wanting to review the record for signs about how Roe v. Wade would be decided before this particular justice. But I think there's a lot of different constitutional issues that stem from Roe v. Wade that I'm hoping the evangelical community becomes just as comfortable discussing, because all of those constitutional issues end up impacting our society. And the idea of the judiciary having the final word on both the executive and the legislative branch is a true threat to democracy. And so I'm just hoping that evangelicals, especially those who do understand the broader context, are comfortable talking about the broader context and not falling into the stereotype that we don't really understand the judiciary very well. We just want Roe v. Wade overturned.
What do you think the White House learned after all is said and done?
Oh, goodness. Well, I hope the White House learned that there is a very large group of Americans who are both evangelical, who are conservative, who have all kinds of different concerns, and they are united by a desire to make sure the Supreme Court does not continue to usurp its power. And so even people of different perspectives, let's say on Roe v. Wade, are united in this idea that it is alarming that the Supreme Court is flexing its muscle and exerting this kind of influence within our democracy. And we're going to push back. And if someone like a Harriet Myers is put forth who has no experience in constitutional law, who has nothing that she can offer by way of a record where we could evaluate how she would apply constitutional law, it's simply not going to be good enough.
Amy White is a mother of two children in Oakville. She's a corporate and political speechwriter and author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Rejection of Myers' Debunked Stereotypes. On some things, evangelicals require more than faith alone. Amy, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
You can read this column of Amy's, very interesting and insightful, at stltoday.com, stltoday.com. Look for Amy White's column, Rejection of Myers' Debunked Stereotypes, stltoday.com. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November. We are just in the opening days of this great month, and we've got a great book for this month. I would say, in my book, second greatest book ever, the Book of Concord. It's a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions. What makes Lutherans Lutheran? What do they believe? What must they believe to bear that name? It's found in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, a reader's edition of the Book of Concord. The book is $20.99 plus shipping and handling. That is a steal, by the way. You're talking about over 700 pages of real scholarly work and very readable as well, beautifully illustrated. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Call them this afternoon, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Concordia, a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions. For the remainder of this hour, our guest here in Studio A, and it is a rare pleasure to have him here in Studio A, Dr. Uwe Simonetto. We've often heard him during our religion roundups here on Issues Etc. Well, he has moved, or I guess is in the process of still bringing some of his stuff down from D.C. to St. Louis, where he's going to be for the time being. Dr. Simonetto joins us to talk about lay vocation. He's resident scholar and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media for Concordia University in Bronxville, New York. Well, Dr. Simonetto, welcome back.
It's wonderful to be here. A wonderful time of the year to be here, too.
You have come to St. Louis at one of the most beautiful times of the year.
That's right, and I hope it remains that way for the next 5 years or whatever, however long I'm going to be here. Anyway.
Now, tell us, let's start broadly on the issue of vocation. Most people hear this and they will think, in the American context, they're going to think some sort of a kind of a factory job. That's what we talk about, vocation.
Right.
But the theological sense of that word is a little bit different. What is vocation?
Well, vocation is, this is the great discovery of the Reformation, of Luther in particular, going back to Paul, Ephesians, that not only are priests called or ministers called by God to serve God in the church, but we all are called by God to our different vocations, journalists, bakers, butchers, housewives, students, teachers, etc., etc. Somehow I have the feeling that Lutherans, not just in this country, but the world over, have forgotten this beautiful insight because it was a trademark of Lutheranism, because it says if you perform your work in your vocation to the best of your ability out of love for your neighbor, then you're rendering the highest service to God. And the famous sociologist of religion, Max Weber, explained that the high quality of Lutheran, in quotation mark, products in the past, Volvo in Sweden, Mercedes-Benz in Germany, Zeiss and other things, are linked to this doctrine, because these people who were practicing Lutherans performed their work so well, knowing that they served God by serving their neighbors. And it seems that nowadays most Lutherans believe, well, if, my lay vocation is chalice bearer at service or something like that. Well, this is not what it is at all. The lay vocation takes place in the left-hand kingdom in the world, and we are, as Christians, called to engage the world. And it's one of, for example, one of the greatest scandals in my mind, given that we have this wonderful doctrine, that there are only about 20, 23 Lutheran congressmen, or Lutherans in Congress, congressmen and senators. We should be fully engaged there. Very, very few Lutherans in the media in prominent positions. That is something that I'm looking at, and that that I would like to impart in conferences, seminars, classes. I'd like to travel about and tell congregations that, and encourage pastors to encourage their congregants to embrace their work in the world and serve the world in the world.
The American religious context. Americans know kind of two things: the Protestant work ethic,
right,
which I think is significantly different than a scriptural doctrine of vocation.
Right.
And that's become very, very much in the 21st century melded with the American dream.
Right.
That is, everyone kind of pursues their own enlightened self-interests, makes their own money, and in the end, it all works out best for everybody if everyone kind of pulls themselves up by their own bootstraps.
Then, and this is, of course, that is Weber's discovery.
Yes.
The Protestant ethic is that, it's, mind you, a slightly warped Calvinistic doctrine, that if you generate money and generate income, it's not actually work ethic, it's just the accumulation of money. That is a measure by which you can plumb your state of grace, which of course is totally absurd. Whereas the biblical approach is, yes, you go out and you work. You were, when you were sent from paradise, well, it was a thorns and thistles experience. But at the same time, nowhere does the Bible say that you shouldn't make a living out of that. Nowhere does the Bible say you shouldn't enjoy it. But you are working not for your own benefit primarily, but for the others. And then that distinguishes Lutheranism from many other Protestant denominations.
What happens, let's talk about the European context,
right,
a little bit, with which you are very familiar. What happens to the culture in Europe, once very Christianized, I'll use that term advisedly, where the doctrine of vocation is either woefully misunderstood or abandoned altogether?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples from my homeland in Germany. I mentioned certain products, and I won't badmouth one particular product, but it used to be the symbol of high-quality German work, and it is now ridiculed, and quite rightly, as shoddy workmanship. And that was built by people, that was created by people who were dedicated Lutherans. Take another thing. Take the current political situation in Germany, which to me as a German is so distressing, I sometimes could shake them all and pour water over them, cold water preferably, wake them up. Here's what has happened. We've had since World War II, one government after another of responsible leaders who rebuilt a disgraced nation, Adenauer, Erhard or the Social Democrats, Willy Brandt, Helmut Schmidt, I mean, from both sides of the aisle. And now one has the feeling that they're only thinking of themselves. And I particularly blame the sovereign here. And the sovereign, of course, in a democracy is the people. And if the people cannot make up their minds whom to elect because they want to continue in their slovenly well-being for yet another 4 years, please, 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 let's have two more vacations per year at 4 to 5 weeks apiece or six, you know, and oh, no, let's just, we don't have to work too hard, and let's just have another champagne party in the evening. I mean, this is what has become to Germany. This is why we have a wobbly government. It's now over 6 weeks since the elections. We still don't have a new government in place. This is like a banana republic. Here is orderly Germany behaving like Nicaragua in the days past, and it's continuing like that. And it drives me nuts. And this is the sovereign, namely the people, has no sense of calling, of vocation to serve the neighbor. They don't have even the sense of making decisions with the future of their own children in mind, so that they may just have another holiday in Tenerife. And God forbid that we should work harder again, as we used to. Germans used to be known as hard workers. They become slobs. They don't want to work anymore. Well, there are many who still do, but these are working for the majority who don't want to work. That is the problem. And that is where we've lost our way, and which was a Lutheran way.
We're talking with Dr. Uwe Simonetto about lay vocation. He is resident scholar and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media for Concordia University in Bronxville, New York. He joins us here in Studio A for the next 25 minutes on the other side of this break. If you have a question or a comment, as we talk about your vocation, my vocation, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Coming up a little later in the program, Dr. Bob Weiss will be our guest. We'll be talking with him about end-of-life issues as they pertain to bioethics. He'll be one of the speakers at the Image of God Bioethics Conference coming up Friday, November the 11th here in St. Louis. And when we come back, we're going to talk about this doctrine of vocation with Dr. Uwe Simonetto. You know, everyone says they're working for the weekend. We're just working for that little spot in the week where we can take it easy. Scripture says, well, there's nothing wrong with a little rest. But we're not working for the weekend. We're working for our neighbor. And that's the way things work best. When we come back, we'll talk about that. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Thursday on Issues Etc. Stay tuned later in the program. Near the end, we're going to be playing Soundbite of the Week. We've got some sound from today's program, from programs previous this week, and we're going to be asking you, which is the best soundbite of the week? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Luther's famous for saying that you don't need your good works, God doesn't need your good works, but your neighbor does. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you want to know what the Lutheran Reformation was really all about? There is a book that every son or daughter of the Lutheran Reformation must read. It's the Lutheran Confessions. They are the original confessions of the Lutheran Reformers. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November is called Concordia, a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions. It's $20.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for Concordia, a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November. Rediscover the Reformation as you read Concordia, a reader's edition of the Lutheran Confessions, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Should people ever be called garbage? This Global Minute focuses prayer on people in the Philippines who are thought of as trash. Children who live in the streets of Manila and their families are called garbage using the Filipino word for trash that's carried along by a river current strewn along the banks. Even some Christians carry this attitude toward the poorest in Manila. Missionaries with Action International Ministries work in partnership with concerned Filipino Christians and other ministries to hold Bible studies, build solid homes, and provide job training for street kids. More Christians are needed to help serve the poor and give them the skills needed to leave desperate poverty and live productively in Christ. Pray for more street children and their families to embrace Christ. Discover how you can get involved. Visit Action's website, actionintl.org, actionintl.org.
The Meyer Minute is underwritten by the North St. Louis County Chapter of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, including Christ the King Lutheran Church on Washington Street and Lutheran Church of the Living Christ on Concord Drive.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Psalm 90, verse 10 says, "The days of our years are 70 years and 10. Now, I'm not quite 60 years, but it's taken all my lifetime to see my Chicago White Sox win the World Series. Last night, they did it. In the 1950s, I would watch the Sox on WGN-TV, black and white TV. I can still see that one camera shot they used from behind home plate, looking out toward the arches of Old Comiskey Park. When Dad took Bruce and me to see our first game, I can see that too, like it was yesterday. Green grass, color, field of dreams. 70 years and 10, and if by reason of strength they be 80, yet is their strength labor and sorrow. 80? More than that, 88 years since our last world championship. When they lost to the Dodgers in 1959, after a 40-year absence from the series, Cousin John predicted it would be another 40 years before the Sox returned. Wrong. 46 years. Labor and sorrow. This is the way some of us have defined the days of our lives, waiting for the Sox to make it. Thanks to Dad for taking us to our first game. Green grass, color, a kid's glimpse of heaven. Deja vu, a momentary deliverance today from labor and sorrow.
How would you like to meet Issues Etc. regular guests Wesley Smith, Beverly Yonke, Gene Edward Veith, James Lamb, Bob Weiss, David Menton, and Nathan Jastrom all in one day? Well, they'll be speaking at the Image of God Bioethics Conference Friday, November the 11th at the Sheraton Westport Lakeside Chalet in St. Louis. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and join us as we broadcast live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference November the 11th in St. Louis. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about lay vocation with Dr. Uwe Simonetto, a regular guest here on the program. And he's been kind enough to join us here in Studio A. He's making the move to St. Louis, where he will serve as resident scholar and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on lay vocation. And he'll also be spending some time well over on the East Coast in Bronxville, New York, at Concordia University, where he will serve as director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media there at Concordia University in Bronxville. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Art, who calls from South County. Art, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, back in the 70s, I first heard of Switzerland complaining about the economic migrants and the drug problems, and then with the eventual appearance of this globalization and this global one world community, it became rather apparent that this was being infectious and it was prevailing throughout the world. You know, it also then was apparent that this migrant was going into the Western European countries, primarily Turkish and Balkan persons working for cheaper labor, and they were also being allowed by the government to work 20 years, then to return to their country of origin with a pension from the government. I think this here United Nations human rights documentation of open borders has given these governments and politicians the thought that they can go ahead and reelect themselves by giving these here people that come into the country benefits in programs that are more advantageous and attractive than the individuals that are being burned in the country.
Art, thank you for the call. All right, Uwe, you're someone who benefits from being able to cross borders and do business across borders.
Yes, I am an immigrant to this country. Art, you know, I'm addressing now vocation, but there's one aspect that you touched on. The question is, have we imported in Europe laborers, especially from Muslim countries, whose descendants could become very dangerous in the future and actually threaten the very fiber of our society, as you witness now if you read what's going on in Paris. And one might say, well, yeah, well, it's been done because people didn't no longer feel the calling to put cars together at Volkswagen or to sweep streets or God knows what else. Now, one thing has to be said here, at least where Germany is concerned, these imports, in quotation mark, were very, very important and essential because so many German men had died in combat during a war that there was a severe shortage of laborers after the war. So in a sense, there was a reason for that. And, you know, it would be then inhuman to not give these people who came in and helped rebuild Germany or France the benefit of these societies. The globalization issue is another deal that we may discuss at another point, but it's not what I'm addressing. What I'm addressing here at my institute in this afternoon is whether we as Christians are aware that God calls us to serve our neighbors in this world, meaning in the world, in our daily endeavors, in as bakers, at whatever we are, and whether we realize what we're doing here or whether it is self-serving, that we just serve ourselves and have a nice long weekend. That is the point that I'm trying to address here today.
I want you to address something that was really very much a matter of debate here in the U.S. about a year ago, that right around the time of the presidential elections. There was one of the largest religious groups in the United States, of course, is Roman Catholic Church. Yeah. And they were kind of brought to the forefront by one of the presidential candidates that many Roman Catholic lawmakers were able to very neatly compartmentalize their faith and their practice in the service of, as elected officials, yeah, whether the legislators or whether they're presidents or whatever. In particular on the issue of life, they were able to say, now look, I believe that life begins at conception. I believe that abortion is wrong, but I represent a diverse population and I cannot allow my religious views to influence how I serve the people of America. Your thoughts?
Yeah, if I could bring a very unpopular analogy here, but I don't mind making enemies that late in my life. Imagine somebody said, well, I'm actually against gassing Jews, but I represent a district full of Nazis, so therefore I had to favor the gassing of Jews. What would people say to that? Now, there are, of course, there are areas where the two kingdoms meet. For example, the issue of life is a political issue which is very much part of the left-hand kingdom, the world, as much as it is part of the right-hand kingdom, which is the church. But then, you know, that is natural law, where if a politician says, well, I actually grant you that theft is something unpleasant. However, I have to close my eyes to because I represent a neighborhood full of thieves, then you would say this guy should be kicked out and booted out. But when human lives and innocent human lives like unborn babies are at stake, that seems to work out. I think it's unbelievably bad, and it sets a terrible example for the rest of society, because suddenly your ethics, your basic innate feelings about sanctity of human life no longer matter as long as it is politically expedient. That is, of course, the very contrary, the very opposite of what I'm trying to push here, which is a sound doctrine of vocation.
If vocation, Christian vocation, is misunderstood, what becomes of very key concepts in just the basic functioning of any society, like justice? What becomes of that if vocation is missing?
A lawyer said that to me, I agree with you, such and such a thing is not, is unjust. However, it's legal. Now, that is newspeak. That is what in Greek is called diabalein, turning things upside down. If you can promote something that is unjust on the basis of its being legal, which is, of course, what we have with Roe versus Wade, your former interview partner here, then, of course, we have a society in a tailspin, because we know nothing is then, you have no longer any standards. You can poison your customers in order to get new customers. Or you can, if you make bread, you fill it with marijuana or cocaine and sell it to them, and they all get a high and come back for seconds. I mean, you can do whatever you please, but that's not what calling is all about.
You also mentioned when we were talking during the break that one of the thoughts that one of the examples of an abandonment of a Christian concept of vocation is women in combat. How so, Uwe?
Well, at the beginning of the Iraq War, the one thing that of the many interviews that irked me greatly, but the one thing that irked me most was an interview with a mother of three toddlers down somewhere in the Carolinas, who traipsed off to combat to spend sweaty, smelly hours in a Humvee with other soldiers, exposing herself to annihilation, which is what soldiers do, leaving her children behind. Nothing can be more irresponsible. It is self-serving. It is it's trying to prove something. It's like those fools, women in particular, now smoking like a chimney with their kids in the car still, saying, I'm so great, I'm like the guys, now I can smoke, you know, and they smoke more and puff away the money. I've seen this, I see this with more and more horror all the time. This is nonsense. People who have been in combat, and I've spent 5 years in combat in Vietnam as a correspondent, know the worst thing that can happen is a woman in combat. She doesn't help her fellow soldiers, because the natural inclination of any soldier, male soldier, is to try and shield and protect a woman. That is how we were born, how we were set up. And it would be totally disastrous to see a fellow soldier, a woman, being ripped to pieces by a shrapnel or by a grenade or what have you. And then to think that this woman has children back home and some husband has to schlep the kids to the kindergarten while she is with some other guys in a Humvee is so outrageous that nobody opposes this. That there are so few organizations, there are a few, thank God, who don't oppose this. Is to me absolutely stunning. It proves to me a degradation of our society.
What it really shows is, and I think this is one of Luther's insights when he comes to vocation, is that while we are called to many vocations in our lives, and they tend to grow and kind of come and go in the course of our lives, there is a priority among them. Right. This is something I encountered as a parish pastor, and that was having to sort out my priorities when it came to my vocation. Right. I was a father and a husband. I was a pastor. I was a citizen. Well, it was a daily struggle to say, especially when the congregation makes demands on its pastor, to say, okay, wife comes first. Kids come first. There is a priority of vocation. Right. And it sounds like part of what you're talking about here is when vocation is abandoned, we don't know what's important anymore.
No, you lose sight of your own standards, and you lose sight of your natural inclinations. If you use, again, the woman who goes into combat, she's trying to prove something which she shouldn't prove, because it is totally contrary to her natural inclination and her role, her calling as a mother, the most important profession one can think of. And this is what I think we have to correct, and where we Lutherans have a particularly strong doctrine, much stronger than most others, other Christians, much more defined, which could set things straight, that teachers are teachers by vocation, that fathers are fathers by vocation, and that don't, that grandparents are grandparents by vocation and don't go off and spend sunny days in Florida and instead of leave the kids to play in the street or something like that. What is wrong with a society where you can't turn to your grandmother anymore because grandmother and grandfather are in a mobile home somewhere in Florida? You know, it's ludicrous. I've been brought up, I don't know where I would be had I not been during World War II, during the bombings in World War II. I spent my childhood under bombs in the arms of my grandmother, comforting me, singing hymns into my ear, teaching me how to pray, donning a rucksack and going to the countryside to collect food from the farmers, selling our chinaware and our porcelain to the farmers so we get a liter of milk. That was for me, was my grandmother. She didn't go off to Bavaria and to the mountains and whoop up lots of beer. She liked her booze. She was a great mother, grandmother. But, I mean, you know, she had priorities.
So let's talk about the functioning of a good society, because Christian vocation, kind of from Luther's pen, is not, and he seems to be equally concerned here, not just good theology. No. It is also good government. It's good society. It is a good way in and of itself, apart from the fact that it's built upon sound theology.
Well, exactly. It is sound theology for the world, really. That's what we're talking about. The kingdom, to the left-hand kingdom, is, of course, also God's kingdom, where he acts in a hidden way. But he has ordered it. And Luther calls us his masks, God's masks. We act as God's masks and as God's representatives, as his cooperators in this kingdom, in the left-hand kingdom, and hopefully, and guided by reason, that's by natural reason, which is very essential, very important. If we return again to the mother in combat, it is totally unreasonable for a mother to expose herself to be killed in combat when she has three toddlers to look after back home in the Carolinas.
You said something there that kind of struck me, and that is the idea that each of us has a place in our families, in government, is also comforting to us personally.
Right.
There's kind of a neuroses in Christianity in America, which is, what is God's will? We're just obsessed with this. What is God's will? What's God's purpose? What does he want me to do? And I've written about this in the past. Christians worrying about what God's will is when it's right under their nose.
Right,
and you can lay your head down at night when it's time to go to sleep and say, I've served my neighbor, not without sin, but I've served my neighbor and I took care of the neighbors right under my nose.
Yeah.
And I don't care what God's will is. God's will is right here under my nose.
That's precisely it. Yeah. Well, that's the Sermon of the Mount. It is clear through the Old Testament. God's will is that we live in this world, engage this world, enjoy this world too. Don't you know? This one thing: eat thy bread with joy and drink thy wine. And you know, for this thy doing has long pleased the Lord. We are here to enjoy this world as well. It's not all grim. But we're to serve, and we are just to serve joyfully, and really good workers, regardless in which vocation, you notice that they do this joyfully. They do this with a smile. They enjoy being journalists, or they enjoy being bakers. They enjoy baking their bread. They enjoy driving a school bus, and jesting with the children. It is a combination, or we don't have to force anything in this life. We just have to act normally. Actually, natural law should tell us that if we serve our neighbor, it is to our benefit as well as to the neighbor's benefit, because the neighbor serves us. And we have an ordered society. And the minute you destroy this network that has been created by God as in the left-hand kingdom, then, of course, the society is bound to falter. And we have seen this now to a considerable extent, especially in the Western world.
I don't know if you gave me this insight or someone else that I talked to on this program. They were talking about art and the way that artisans used to produce their art, but largely for the church.
Yeah.
The church was a great patron of the arts at one time. The statuary that they would make for a church, rather than just finish the front of the statue that everyone would see,
They
finished the back of the statue with equal care. No one would ever see it. The statue might be 25 feet up in the air in a little niche. The back of the statue was finished. Sometimes they'd even write at the back, on the back of it, to God.
Yeah, Soli Deo Gloria, of course, yeah.
Why would they do that? What's changed?
Well, that is actually, it's very interesting that you didn't have it from me, but it's a very interesting concept. The other, if they didn't do that, they would create Potemkin's statues, for example, you know, the famous Potemkin's or Potemkin's villages. You would create something incomplete. And the natural inclination of a sound person is to complete his or her work and not to do something shoddy. If you do something shoddy, I know that when I had to write a story in a hurry and maybe one sentence was not beautifully phrased, but it had to get out fast, you feel uncomfortable. You want to wash your hands afterwards if you're a normal human being. The switch from shoddiness to criminality is not very, it's not a long step, you know. If you produce a shoddy statue for a church, you might be inclined to cheat somebody out of his income or something else because you have no longer standards. And the standards are, I think, built into all of us by God, by the Creator.
Uwe, what's the danger? And this is also another option that is usually taken in American Christianity. The danger is to say, as a Christian community, the culture is a dangerous place and a difficult place for Christians to exist. What we need is a Christian subculture. So we'll have Christian bakers and Christian this, explicitly for serving Christians, kind of to our own, for our own, a Christian ghetto. What's the danger of that?
Well, you create precisely that. You create sects. You become defeatist. And you become arrogant in a way. We are so wonderful. We are Christian bakers. We don't bake for Muslims or Hindus or God forbid, atheists. We just bake for you. The danger is then that Christians move themselves towards the margins of society, which is not where they should be. The opposite should be the case. There should not be Christian journalists, for example, which is something I'm going to teach out in Bronxville, but journalists should be Christians, and especially Lutherans should become journalists. Not Lutheran journalists, but they should be journalists for the secular media with their own built-in doctrine of vocation, of calling. That distinguishes the church, I believe, from the sect. You see, if you are, if you say, I'm an evangelical journalist, then the danger is that the evangelical journalist is actually a sectarian. If you are a journalist who happens to be an evangelical, then it's rightly ordered. Then the evangelical Christian will bring his standards into his work, but not as a member of his particular sect or his particular church, but as a believing Christian operating in the world and engaging the world.
Finally, with only 1 minute here, Uwe, is it a self-centeredness for Christians to say, you know, I'd like to do that in the culture and really engage the culture and become engaged in it, but I'm afraid of getting my hands dirty because the culture is a dirty place?
Well, listen, you get your hands dirty in everything. I mean, it starts when you shovel manure. What's wrong with dirtying your hands? Thank God there's still water and soap about.
Dr. Uwe Simonetto has been our guest here in Studio A. He's a resident scholar and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute, on lay vocation here in St. Louis and director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media for Concordia University in Bronxville, New York. You can meet Dr. C. Minetto at the 10th anniversary banquet for Issues, Etc. It's coming up this Saturday night. He's going to be there as one of our special guests. 5:30 at Wartburg Hall on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We've got only 4 seats left. If you want one of them, call Jenny Williams at 314-505-7836, 314-505-7836. Also in attendance on Saturday night, Dr. Norman Nagel, Dr. Lewis Brighton, Pastor Daniel Preuss, Dr. David Adams will be there, Dr. Reed Lessing, Dr. Ron Feuerhahn, Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel. If you're missing his show, he'll be there Saturday night. You can meet him there as well. Pastor Henry Gehrke, Dr. Larry Rast. Dr. Larry Rast will be the keynote speaker. He's going to be talking about reforming American Christianity. The number 314-505-7836, 314-505-7836. Reserve one of the final 4 seats for the Issues, Etc. 10th Anniversary Banquet at Wartburg Hall on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Uwe, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks. We'll see each other soon again.
Yes, and Godspeed. See you Saturday night.
Thank you, yes. I don't have to bring a hip flask.
No, you don't have to bring a hip flask. We will have wine at the banquet, so don't worry. Probably not as much as Uwe is going to like, but... I'll bring an extra bottle for you, I promise. I promise. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with a little bit later Dr. Bob Weiss in the program. The end of life is a time where issues of bioethics become very, very important. We've learned about this recently with some very prominent cases of people who prematurely are at the end of life. We'll be talking a little later in the program about that very thing. What do we do with people at the end of life, either by sickness, by infirmity, by age? Society says they're expensive. Society says the pragmatic approach would be to simply put them away someplace or put them away altogether. Well, and in a bioethics informed by Scripture and by Christian thinking, how do we deal with the inevitable end of life? We'll talk about it later on the program here on Issues, Etc. Dr. Bob Weiss will be our guest. Then we're also going to be playing a little bit of best soundbite of the week. I think we've got 5 set up for you, and we want your vote on which one is best. A couple from Ted Haggard and that Tom Brokaw NBC special, In God They Trust. We've got one from Father Reardon's sermon that we reviewed early in the week. We've got a soundbite from, let's see, who else do we have there? We've got another from Ted Haggard. We've got a couple in there, and we want you to pick which is best. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.